Welcome to Happy Hour, where we're flipping the script on the traditional happy hour. Instead of winding down with a drink, we're here to talk about what actually makes us happy and learn from society's healers, therapists, coaches, elders, spiritual leaders, and everyone in between. Join us as we dive into stories, insights, and tools that help us grow, heal, and support one another. Whether you're a seeker or a seer, this is for you. I'm Anurag, founder of Happy, and this series will be hosted by myself, along with my co-hosts, Mira and Tess, and we're excited to explore new ways to bring more joy and well-being into our lives. So take a deep breath, and let's dig in.
Hello, hello. My name is Tess Fenn, and I am the host of today's episode of Happy Hour. This being the very first episode that we are premiering, I'm so excited to bring you all into this work. The mission of Happy Hour is really to highlight those doing such important work for our community and our world to help us be healthy and happy. Today's episode is featuring an outstanding therapist by the name of Danielle Levanis, who I've had the pleasure of working with personally and knowing for over a decade. Danielle is incredibly talented and specializes in drama therapy. She works with couples and individuals, and she also does other forms of art therapy, which we'll be discussing during this recording. I'll also note that this recording was done prior to the LA fires, and unfortunately, like many, Danielle was affected deeply by the fires. She's done some great work writing about that experience and the collective grief that we're all experiencing here in Southern California, where she and I both live. And I just want to give her an extra shout out and applause for continuing to process grief aloud and helping to shine a light on how we can all support each other's human experiences. So please enjoy this episode of Happy Hour. Hello and welcome to Happy Hour, Danielle. I'm so happy to have you here. Everyone, this is a really exciting session for me because I get to have a beautiful conversation with my friend and my former therapist, Danielle Levanis, who I hope to work with again someday. But we have a really beautiful relationship, which actually started as a professional relationship as we were both working in the creative arts space on nonprofits. And I really admired her work at the time, which was with a nonprofit called Acme International. Is that correct?
Ask me.
Ask me. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's how I first met Danielle. She is now a practicing therapist who specializes in creative arts therapy with a focus on drama therapy. Yeah. And I'm so happy to, you know, just sort of share with our listeners a little bit about your practice and have a natural conversation with you about what you're observing in the world today, which there's a lot going on. So we are recording this session on November 15th, 2024. And
it has been a week and a half.
Happy to be here with you.
I'm happy to be here too, Tess. Thank you so much.
Would you like to give a little bit of an overview about your practice and, you know, what is drama therapy? What are creative arts therapies?
Sure. Yeah. Drama therapy is kind of under the umbrella of creative arts therapy. So under creative arts therapy, we have art therapy, which is quite well known, dance movement therapy, music therapy. There's drama therapy, poetry therapy, and some others sometimes. But in New York State, they actually have a license for this. And as a licensed creative arts therapist, I got my start working in acute inpatient psych hospitals. So in the New York City Health and Hospitals psych system, they have a creative arts therapist on the clinical team. And the creative arts therapists often run groups, also do assessments and individual work, but it helps kind of bridge kind of the gap between just talk therapy and then like activities. And so we do more experiential, transformational work in the therapeutic realm of relationships typically and creating art. Psych hospitals are really tough places to be as patients. And I think they can be also very hard to work as staff members, but some of the most beautiful experiences I had were in group, where people were able to show up and support each other and really be kind of, you know, invested in not just my own healing, but also like the group healing.
After you got your degree, you went and worked in a hospital like this?
While I was at NYU, my internship was at Bellevue Hospital. So I worked at the on the forensic psychiatric unit. So I worked with men who were from Rikers who were also living with severe and chronic mental illness. They found themselves on the psych unit at Bellevue. And I had some incredible supervisors, and we worked using embodied forms of therapy to help people tap into parts of themselves that maybe they typically didn't see themselves on. So as, you know, being able to be creative and interesting and smart and powerful and all these wonderful things that often are not brought out in terms in the dynamics of being in Rikers or in a psych hospital. And we would do work around adult men. I work solely with adults. Some drama therapists and creative arts therapists work with kids also, but I work with adults. We'd integrate a lot of forms of art making that typically get written off as for children, like puppetry or mask work or improvisational games, theater games. And we would do them in a therapeutic setting, in a relational setting. And they proved to be really powerful projection techniques for people. And so that's kind of I started in inpatient psych and then have kind of moved my way into what I often call like more normal neurotics who are just living and in private practice. They are dealing with anxiety or life transitions or finally dealing with some trauma that they haven't had the opportunity to deal with yet, or addiction or eating disorders, all those things, but just at a different place in the treatment line versus from acute to more outpatient.
Which is how I got to collaborate with you and do some, honestly, like some of my most challenging but most powerful work that I've done in my, I've been seeing therapists off and on since I was about 17, I guess. And so our work together in my early 30s has been really instrumental for me. And it's interesting how even somebody like me who has had other types of therapy or other relationships, you know, with therapists over the years, how that fit can be super important and powerful.
Yes.
And you and I think because we speak a language of creative expression.
Yeah.
I know that I often would send you, for example, poems that I would write. Sometimes I felt like, yeah, I could tell you an account of this event happened, and I feel X. But sometimes the best way for me to express myself is through an artistic expression. And I think all of us, the thing is that, you know, it's not just work that's for people who call themselves creatives, right?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Because
we're all creative. I mean, it's so interesting to think about it. Like, I always come back to the idea that we are storytelling animals. Like, from the beginning of humanity, we have found ways to make meaning of our journey in this lifetime through art, through narrative-based kind of storytelling, through dance, through all these different ways. And it elevates our experience from the day-to-day, the mundane, and it brings it from this individual place to a broader, kind of more profound collective space. And it does allow us to understand what we are going through on an individual basis in a more profound way. And, you know, right now it's interesting because you're talking about what we're dealing with right now. And I mean, we are in an interesting era. There is an epidemic of loneliness that is so pervasive, and it is not just one age group or one socioeconomic group or even one political group. Like, people are struggling with feeling disconnected and feeling isolated from every entry point. The way we're going about trying to find connection might be different, but so many people are struggling. And I think the pandemic obviously brought a lot of things to light, brought a lot of things into motion that we're still kind of recovering from in some ways. But, you know, at its core, I think making art is about being in relationship with people. We have the artist and the and the viewer or the audience, you know, and that's a beautiful relationship. We have the vulnerability of being open and sharing and someone who's receiving. That's another beautiful relationship. And in drama therapy, a lot of my work now revolves around couples working in partnership, in romantic relationships, or in other pairings. I do a lot of work with adult parents and adult children too. And the basis of this relational kind of work is, you know, helping each other find ways to be seen and be heard without activating kind of these defensive mechanisms that shut down so much of these dynamics and can make relationships really challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's some quote that I don't know if I heard it on your Instagram or somewhere else where it talked about creativity being almost like the opposite of fear or anxiety. Because when we are creating, or maybe like the opposite of loneliness, because we are really with ourselves in that experience.
In a really meaningful relationship with ourselves in that process too. Yeah.
So I know a little bit about drama therapy and creative arts therapy, but I don't know that everybody does. So would you mind giving a little bit of an overview of what does this mean? Like, I actually brought it up at a dinner party recently. I brought up drama therapy and my friends were absolutely mind blown by this concept because they had never heard of it. They asked me to explain what it looked like or, you know, what kind of practices it entails. And I had a fun time doing my best to explain to them. And I did a little bit of a mirroring exercise with them where I stood behind them and I asked them, you know, is this what you're feeling like? And you can say yes or no, and then you can expand on it. And they were really moved by that. Wow. So if you don't mind, you know, kind of giving your expression of how you would tell our friends at a dinner party about drama therapy.
Yeah. So, I mean, the technical definition of drama therapy, it is using theatrical forms for a therapeutic purpose. Now that's very broad, right? So, and I would say that in many ways, drama therapists, like all therapists or all kind of therapy modes, it can work with very different populations in different ways. So under the umbrella of drama therapy, we have often a spectrum of what I think on one end is more of a narrative-based storytelling, poetry, kind of role-based work. And the other end is much more nonverbal, much more movement-based, almost like dance movement therapy. So it kind of does run the spectrum. The drama therapy kind of form that people know the best is often psychodrama. And psychodrama often is its own thing, but it has drama therapeutic connections. And psychodrama is that practice of enrolling people in a group setting to play parts in your own life or to play parts in your collective story and then being walking through it with the psychodramatist and experiencing cathartic events through that fictional kind of embodied way. In the drama therapy that I tend to do, I also focus on something called role theory. It works with individuals a little bit more. The idea is that with role theory, it's kind of like parts work with IFS. This idea that we all...
Internal family systems.
Thank you. Internal family systems. Yeah. Yes. So it's kind of similar to this. A little different too, though. In role theory, the idea is that our personality is made up of a multiplicity of roles. And these roles might be defined as feeling roles. They could be the angry one, the ecstatic one, the quiet one, you know, feeling based. It also could be metaphor based, the magician, the fool, archetype roles, right? You can look at the tarot, you can look at Jung kind of archetypal roles, and then also literal roles, mother, child, lawyer, judge, these kinds of things.
Right.
Doctor.
It also makes me think of, now I'm going way back into my theater education as a child. It's called Commedia dell'arte.
Yes, yes. Right? Yes, Commedia.
And there were like There's the
yes, there's like the miser or whatever the yes. And there's all, and yeah, the, so these are archetypes. Jester. Yes, the yeah. fool, the jester. Yes, all of these, exactly. And Jung really built on commedia and, you know, J.L. Moreno, who created like psychodrama, also built on all of these things inform each other. And so drama therapy and rule theory really lives on the back of all of those forms.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, that we're always evolving and we're always learning from each other, even people in history, right? That
yes.
have no idea that they've had this profound impact on future generations of
Absolutely.
Psychotherapists or creators.
Yeah, you think of like the Greek myths. I mean, I just read this book, that book Circe. Have you read that book?
No,
Circe. Oh God, I loved it. But it's like, you know, Greek myths and these like these archetypes, these roles, these metaphors in so many ways. Well, actually, I'm gonna come circle back to that in a second. I want to finish role theory,
okay.
And then I'll circle back to projective techniques. But so the premise is that we play all these roles. Someone who is healthy can fluidly transition between these roles, even if the roles are in contradiction to each other. Even if they're not, there's no good or bad self. There's no right or wrong. There's no true or false. It's just that we play all these parts. And if I'm able to fluidly transition, that means I'm probably well-adjusted and grounded and I'm okay. An unhealthy person or a sick person is limited for any number of reasons to a similar cluster of like roles. So it could be society projects a certain type of role on me and then I in it unconsciously act it out, or because it's reflected back at me so many times, I adopt it. Or I'm in a system that only allows for me to have, or a family that only allows for me to play a certain role. Say my sister is the star athlete. Okay, I can't play. I'm not going to be the star athlete. So that role becomes one that's unattainable for me or unavailable to me, you know? So when we look at it this way, healing comes from being able to expand the roles that we have in our repertoire. And it allows for this relational component to come into.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I've been thinking a lot about these things as I mentioned offline before we started recording. You know, I've had a bit of a career transition and you know, one of the things that in earlier moments in my life that I resisted was actually like my athleticism. So it's interesting to hear you talk about. That role, because I recently discovered that, I actually really enjoy moving my body. And, I do get a little bit competitive if I play racket sports, for example. And, like, that's actually really fun for me.
And that's you expanding your roles so that you can actually identify as someone who is an athlete or is competitive in a way that's healthy and fun and playful and expansive.
Yes. Not not to, you know,
no.
Call out my brothers, but my brothers are both outstanding, like very, very well recognized athletes. My older brother won 3 state tennis tournaments when we were in high school. And, you know, I was always kind of like the artistic one. So it's interesting.
Right. So you almost pigeonholed yourself, but you also probably you were drawn to it, too. Right? You liked the arts. Well, you liked art. And then you're like, but it's also the thing that I have room for in my family. So I'm going to identify with that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, in role theory, some of the things that we can do is we can use these roles that we either over rely on or under utilize these parts of ourselves. Right. And we can recalibrate. So if we're finding ourselves in a relationship that is really unsatisfying or problematic, it could be a work environment, it could be a home environment, it could be at school, looking at what's the role that's really active for me right now? I feel like I'm the nagging mother in my relationship at home with my partner. I don't like that, you know? Looking at, what's on the other side of that? You know, what's the role in relationship to that for you? And if on the one side of the nagging mother is the free, carefree, creative one, then we can say, okay, how do we utilize some of the wisdom of the carefree one and bring it into your relationship so that you're feeling like the dynamic can change. Because so often these patterns get built in that get solidified because we don't feel like we have a clear vision of what is happening. And then we don't have any understanding of how to shift it ourselves besides the other person changing. And so by having a frame for our understanding of how we contribute to the dynamic at play that might be unsatisfying or this doesn't work in cases of abuse. Let me just say, like, this, we're not talking about abusive relationships. I would use a different frame, but if the relationship is not abusive, but say it's just unsatisfying or stuck, we can start saying, well, what can I do differently to bring a different element, a different part of me to the conversation, which then allows the other person to bring something different too.
Absolutely. And it's amazing how that shift can make such a big difference.
Yeah.
I know, you know, for my experiences in relationships, sometimes we get so stuck on if this other person changes this one thing or could change in this way, I would feel so much more free. But we forget how much power that we have. And when we do the work and are able to move in ourself and evolve to other modalities of or other ways of expressing ourselves, sometimes it frees the other person also to not stay in that same role, right?
Yes, because any dynamic in a relationship is co-created. It's never just one person who's creating the entire. Again, I'm going to stipulate, unless we're talking about severe personality disorder or severe abuse. But for the most part, if it's a consensual relationship where people are mutually engaged, a dynamic is co-created. And so, yes, our partner, we want our partner to change, but also what am I doing to reinforce the stuckness? And then this also leads to what I was going to say earlier about projectives. Sometimes in drama therapy, and all creative arts therapies, I would say, we use metaphor, stories, and a thing we call projective techniques to bring a little bit of distance for us. When I'm talking about my conflict with my mom, it might be too hard, too close for me to have a clear vision of what's going on. And that's okay. There's appropriate spaces for us to vent, for us to process, for us to feel flooded and have be held in that. That's okay. But if we're looking for an alternative way of approaching it, sometimes we need to bring a little bit of distance. And that might be, instead of I'm talking about my mom, I'm talking about, a serpent and a sailor, how through the story can we help the sailor being me, who is triggered by the serpent being my mother, how can we help find other ways of looking at it and other creative ways to explore the impulse that I'm feeling and allow it to elevate it so that I can process it in a way that feels like I'm actually being seen and heard. And we can do that through poetry, puppetry, embodiment forms, art making, any number of ways that we can allow these metaphors to then hold what feels so big for us.
That's so beautiful. I'm remembering a couple encounters I've had like that where I've really just accessed a part of expressing myself that I wasn't able to previously. And I remember the feeling of feeling actually so understood and so connected with the other person that I was sharing these stories with, right? We do this, in dynamics with children, right? When we're telling them stories, we tell them stories and we try and teach them lessons through these stories. But how do we tell ourselves these kinds of stories? And
Exactly. And I think part of it is that we have these tools. Again, these are tools that pretty much every culture since the beginning of humanity utilizes in one way or another, right? It's not limited to certain parts of the world or certain types of people. Like, this is a very human process. We have these tools that we kind of push away and lock up in a box for children. And we don't let adults access them. And so like one of the things that I talk a lot about is this concept of play. And I don't mean play as in, oh, we're so silly, we're having like, you know, crazy, silly times. I'm talking about play as in an experience where I am grounded and rooted to who I am. I am present in the moment, and I have the flexibility and spontaneity to not be afraid of making mistakes. And right. that experience yes. is that optimal place where we can really tap into a sense of growth and a sense of healing from that place if we can access it more. And so much of what we talk about with anxiety, this over identification with fear-based thinking about the future, control of the future, depression, right. this over kind of shameful blaming of what happened in the past. So much of it is about mm-hmm. not being in that middle space of, you know, like it's what Buddhism talks about, like presence, mindfulness, that mindful moment where you really are engaged and you have your ability to think and feel and be seen and present all happening at the same time. And so that state of play is what we try to explore and find in drama therapy. And finding that in a group setting can be that healing element of, you know, dealing with any other type of system we've been in that hasn't been healing or hasn't seen us. And we can have those as if experiences that are truly profound.
Wow. Yes. First of all, I don't know that I've ever heard a description of depression and anxiety mm-hmm. that has connected with me so deeply as how you just described both yeah. of them. Yeah. The depression being an obsession with things in our past that we are blaming or shaming ourselves for that, frankly, we have no control over any yeah. longer.
Yeah.
Right. And then anxiety being, you know, trying to work out something that might happen in the future. And in our minds, in a way that's actually detracting from us yeah. working towards our goals on a day-to-day right. basis.
Right.
So that one really connected with me. Thank you for that. What is the term for like in a group setting when you're doing a enactment?
Enactment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's called enactment. Great.
Yeah. So I mean, in psychodrama, it's called enactment. In drama therapy and role theory, like it's enactment typically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've had the pleasure of doing some enactments, and I did one actually when I was at NYU as well, mm-hmm. training under a similar, I think we had the same
Jan
teacher
Cohen-Cruz?
Actually.
Was it Jan Cohen-Cruz?
No,
who was it?
Not Jan. I'm not remembering her name at the moment, okay. but she always said, wear life like a loose sweater.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, who was that? Yeah.
She was very lovely. But so we did this exercise where every class, people would, she would give a prompt. So for example, this particular day, the prompt was, who is somebody that you would like to have a conversation with who for reasons of either they've passed away or mm. there's some limiting ability for them to have a truthful, clear conversation with you. And my proposal was to have a conversation with my grandmother about her experiences when she was in a situation of domestic violence with my biological grandfather and right. situation of continued violence with her second husband. You know, why wasn't she able to kind of see what was happening and take mm. action to support and protect herself and her right. children? Mm-hmm. And so my class supported me and chose my story to enact. And I was able to have a conversation with my grandmother who, you know, I don't know, she was once said to have dementia. Now we're not sure that she has dementia, but she just isn't available for right. that conversation, right?
Sure. Yes.
So I've never been able to actually have that conversation with her. And so doing this enactment, I was able to ask her questions and see her and say, you know, Grandma, what's going on in your life? You know, like what's scaring you? And, you know, why aren't you able to protect your children?
Right.
And you know, it reminded me actually that this was the 1960s. My grandmother grew up in very traditional families that really believed in division marriage, of gender and
gender.
Gender roles. And, you know, she believed that it was vital to have a man as part of the family unit to co-parent.
It wasn't an option to
even
leave.
If that man.
Yeah.
Well, and she did leave. She left the first time.
Right. She but then left she found the, herself in it again. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. As so many of us do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Repeat patterns of what's familiar and you know, what we see as expressions of love. It enabled me to have a really deep respect for her and understanding. I already had a deep respect for her because she's been a wonderful grandmother to me, but just an understanding of the challenges that she was really facing.
Right. And not just an intellectual understanding, but a physical understanding. When you are going through those enactments and you are walking through them with, you know, the facilitator, and then, you know, you have people who are standing in and playing the roles of these people in your lives, there's a different experience of processing, of being knowing, and of releasing some of the things that we hold, because it's not just intellectual, it's also in our body.
Yeah. Is the term for that somatic?
Yes. Yes, that's the word. You got it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Nailed it.
You nailed
it. Awesome.
So yeah, these somatic practices are so profound and so important because it gives it. Yeah. I mean, I think the brain science is there. I'm probably not going to be able to describe it really well, but like, you know, it moves something from one part of our brain to the other. And so it goes into a different place of processing and of knowing.
Right.
And that is how we move through trauma. Like, I would say that, and you're not necessarily describing your own trauma, but you're describing your experience of witnessing someone who experienced trauma and not understanding why they weren't able to help themselves, right? And when we experience trauma, so much of the work is bringing it from a place of, well, from your experience, it was understanding, integrating understanding. If you were the one experiencing the trauma, the work is about bringing from a place of physical activation into a narrative of that brings kind of language to something that by virtue of what happens has no language. Because when we experience trauma, it's in sensations, sounds, physical, blah, 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 blah. It's all active here. It doesn't have a lot of narrative or words. And so by bringing it into language or bringing it into a relational realm, it stops becoming our own trauma and it starts becoming something we share and we can process and work through.
Yeah, that's so powerful.
Yeah, it is.
I wanted to talk a little bit about some frameworks, because I know that when I learn about tools or frameworks that help me think about what's going on in various dynamics, it really helps me, I guess, get out of myself a little bit and be able to see my role in something.
Yes. Yes.
So we talked about a couple different frameworks that we wanted to explore, but I'll let you kind of talk about, you know, if you want to talk about, I mentioned Cartman.
The Cartman drama triangle. Yeah.
Drama triangle. But you mentioned another one that we might be able to kind of explore and do a hands-on experiment with.
I mean, the first one, I think we can look at Cartman's drama triangle, which is this idea that in any given conflict between two people, typically we're moving around a triangle in a very stuck way. So on this triangle, Cartman's drama triangle, we have the victim, we have the rescuer, and we have the perpetrator. Say my husband and I are having a conflict about the mental load in the household, and I'm frustrated with him for not doing the dishes.
Sounds like something a lot of people can relate to.
I think a lot of people probably relate to it. Yes. I mean, this is an example I was working through with a couple not too long ago. We have choices how we enter into these discussions. Often, however, how we enter in doesn't feel like a choice. And so one of us will come in and maybe I'd walk in and I'd say, "You never do the dishes. I'm always the one who does this. I'm the only one who's being taken care of any of this. So I'm playing the victim,
right?
I'm the victim. I'm the victim. When I come into an into an encounter with the from a victim place, my partner has two options, both which are very unsatisfying. He can either defend himself, i.e. be the perpetrator role. What are you talking about? I do everything around here. Or you never do other things. What do you, you don't do the trash. You don't do da-da-da into the perpetrator role. Or he could be the rescuer role. Okay, you're right. Let me fix it. How can I fix it? I'm bad. You're right. Now the rescuer role could very quickly move into the victim role. And then when he moves into victim, I get put into two other options. Do I move into perpetrator or rescuer? Like it's, we're bopping around this triangle in a way that gets so stuck that we don't even see what's happening.
Right.
And with the Carpen drama triangle, the first step is to pause and say, okay, where am I on the triangle right now? Even if I'm showing up as the rescuer, let me help you. Let me help you. What do you need? What do you need? It's disempowering to my partner because he has two unsatisfying places. Either he's the victim, I'm helpless, or he's like fighting back against me saying, I don't need your help. We put ourselves in these positions and relationships that once we can see where we are, the goal is to get off the triangle. And instead of being the rescuer.
So how do we get off?
How do we get off? Yeah. The first step is noticing, right? In a series of change, we're always, the first step is noticing. We notice, we say, oh, I see. I'm playing the victim. I'm noticing it. Then once we notice, we have to let ourselves feel some things about the noticing. Because guaranteed, if you're playing the victim in this one relationship, in this one dynamic, it is not the first time you played it or the first time you've witnessed it. So we start having feelings about it. Maybe we witnessed this as children. Maybe our parents were in the same dynamic. Or maybe that was a dynamic that we played out in a different relationship in our lives. So we have to start allowing feeling to come in. And that might be anger, frustration, rage, sadness, grief. Once we move through the feelings, we then bring some acceptance to it. And the feelings have to be shared, I believe. It can't just be something we do on our own. You can journal, you can talk to friends, you can talk to a therapist, but we can't just feel it on our own. Because in sharing it, it moves from something that is secret and my own into something that is manageable and a little bit outside myself. And that allows us to get some acceptance and some perspective. And in this step process of noticing, feeling, accepting, this doorway to change starts opening up without even trying. And all of a sudden we have other options to be able to, we have other options available to us. I can change the way I show up, but it's, I'm not, I can't do it because I'm trying to, I'm doing it because I've done this work around it. So when we move off the triangle, it means we're being willing.
I feel like an important step there that I want to make sure to like double click on is the feeling part.
Yes.
Because you can notice it, right? And you can say, okay, I'm playing the victim again, or I'm playing the rescuer again. Yep. You can just say like, okay, you know, Tess, like, let's move out of this role. Like, but without feeling it, without saying, okay, like, this is a role that I'm way too familiar with that I feel really sad about playing again and again. Or like, you know, this is just a role that I was trained to enact since I was a young child.
Right. It was modeled to me.
And it's been my survival mechanism.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not the only way. Yeah. And I can say thank you to it and like have this experience with it for protecting me or helping me during difficult times, but now it's not my only choice.
100%. And you just perfectly described the process of going from noticing to acceptance. And in the middle of that process is the feeling. And through that process of noticing, feeling, bringing some acceptance or at least like self-compassion around it, then we have different options available to us. And it gives us a different place to engage from. I'm not as activated. I'm not as charged. I'm moving off the triangle because we only stay on the triangle if we participate in it. If I'm not picking up the bait, if you're enrolling me as the rescuer, but I say, nope, not going to do this. I love you and I support you, but I'm not fixing it for you. And I step off. There's no triangle anymore. it's just very hard to do because so often we find ourselves in these dynamics that it feels so necessary. There's urgency to re-engage. There's urgency to stay on the triangle because it activates some part of ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that urgency.
I think just having that awareness about what this triangle is and how often we get into these triangles. And then also that when we are in one position, it really limits the other person to have those two other.
I think that's like the element with codependency, right? That I think is so hard. Mm-hmm. If say, you know, someone's in a family dynamic with someone who has an addiction problem or is struggling with addiction, so often they become the scapegoat or the problem. But we forget to look at the person who is enabling this process and continues to stay engaged in the process. Whereas when they really, it's the rescuer role, they really could just step off. Very hard to do, easier said than done, even hard to see. But once we step off, it empowers the person who's in that victim role to then have a different option also.
Right.
A more satisfying option potentially. Yeah. And then the other thing, kind of with Cartman's drama triangle that I like, and I think you kind of alluded to this when you were talking about the psychodramatic enactments you were talking about, is that you don't have to be talking about it with the other person necessarily. There are a lot of relationships in our lives that we can't really fix. Like we can't change, often we can't change our parents. Or you know, often in family dynamics, there's things that we can't change about someone. And so if we can at least just see, oh, this is why I'm so activated. They're drawing me in because they're playing the perpetrator or they're playing the victim or they're playing the rescuer. If we can just see that happening, we then have a little bit more of a frame to have some perspective on it and be like, it's not about me. I'm not a bad person. I'm not doing something wrong. And then we can give ourselves a little bit of space, and that can be releasing that healing fantasy of by engaging with them, it's going to change. If I find the right words to say, or I find the right angle, or I show up one more time, you know, there's that belief, that healing fantasy of like, it will work. And if we actually look at it as actually, I'm still on the drama triangle. Like we're still keeping ourselves in the same dance we've been doing. It releases us from that pressure to kind of be the one who fixes it.
Wow, powerful. I'm feeling that just with various things going on in my life and how can I use this and think about that and how do I jump off myself? And then there was another model that we were talking about that I actually don't know much about. So
role theory is this other model I kind of alluded to in drama therapy, and there's this role theory and method, and we have an assessment tool in drama therapy where there's like a deck of anywhere from 70 to 80 cards that have roles on them. And in
that's cool.
Yeah, it's and the roles come from kind of a collection of mostly Western plays and literature. Someone came down and started looking at what roles are repeated in these stories, in our collective.
That's
kind
so
of
fascinating.
Yeah. And so we create, there's this taxonomy of roles. And then there's also people who are still doing work to expand upon this taxonomy to make roles that are more, I think intentionally underserved or disempowered populations and groups often don't find themselves mirrored in this taxonomy of Western white literary roles. So how do we kind of build upon? So this is a practice that is changing all the time, but we create our taxonomy of roles that we're going to work with. And then you would place every card in the deck in one of four columns. And the four columns are who I am, who I want to be, who gets in the way, and who can help. And
amazing.
Through the process of doing this, we kind of go through this process of every role puts in one column. And then you and I, as client and therapist, would take a step back and I would say, okay, tell me about this. There's no one way to interpret the role of a zombie. But if you put zombie in who I am and you tell me a little bit about why, or you put that in who gets in the way and you tell me a little bit about why, that's an entry point into you sharing how you see yourself in the world and what issues and what struggles you're up against. And that allows me as the drama therapist to be the learner and you as the client to be the teacher. And it subverts the power dynamic that is implicit in a lot of Western psychiatric and psychological models. Because so much of this work, and this is coming back to what we talked about with relationships, so much of this work is about the fit.
Right.
I don't come in saying, I know how to fix you, Tess. I know the problems you're dealing with and I'm going to fix you. We're all struggling and we're all doing our best. And you're probably the expert on your own life, but we can't always see everything in ourselves. So the therapist acts as a mirror to help reflect back to you ideas, thoughts, reactions, possibilities, which then engages a different kind of understanding. And we build a relationship that becomes about you being able to understand yourself better.
Yeah. And I think that that's such an important description of therapy, because I think for many people, you know, there's an idea that therapy is for people who are quote unquote sick. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And while we all have different layers of health and challenges, you know, I see therapy as an important mechanism for personal accountability, growth, exploration. You know, it's not about fixing something that's sick always.
Right. Yes, totally. And it's not even about fixing. It's about expanding, because often we're not trying to get rid of the parts of you that often the things that you are coming in with saying, hey, this is a problem for me. It's often a shadow side of something you're very proud of. So we're not trying to get rid of that part of you. Anxiety is the shadow side of someone who's, you know, highly thoughtful, highly productive, on top of things, like all these very qualities that we would say you want to keep. So we're not trying to get rid of these parts of you. We're trying to expand your understanding of how to work with them, how to built in practices that help you deal with it differently.
You know, for me, one of the biggest advances that I feel like I've had with my relationship with myself in this last year has been more of an acceptance of my emotions.
Yeah.
Because I've always been this person who is quick to emotion. You know, somebody who gets excited easily, but also somebody who gets tearful easily. Somebody who gets scared easily. I hate horror movies, for example. And I've learned to say, you know, this is a beautiful part about myself. If I have an experience that moves me to tears, sometimes it's a positive experience.
Absolutely.
And people are like, why is she crying? Instead of being like, I'm so sorry I'm crying, I'm starting to embrace, wow, I'm having this experience. And isn't that
so
beautiful?
Important. Like, it's so important.
And so I feel like my work has enabled me to get to this place, because frankly, I don't think it's going away. It's just a part of who I am. I have to love it.
Yeah. And I think, like, once we can bring acceptance, again, this is kind of talking about the steps to the create change. Once we can bring about acceptance, we can build nuance in. So, like, you can work on saying, like, I am a highly emotional, attuned person. My superpower and one of my, like, deepest fears, is, you know, or weaknesses is that I can cry on demand or whatever.
Yeah.
Once we bring acceptance to that, you can start realizing, okay, when can I tap into that? And when do I want to kind of turn the volume down a little bit? So it's about nuance, too. It's that it's not just black or white. It's not all or nothing. It's that in certain settings, I can let that part of me out a little more, and it's not scary, it's not bad, it's not overwhelming. In other settings, I want to turn the volume down a little bit more. But once we're in relationship with it, it's not like an evil secret in the closet, you know? It's going to jump out and destroy our lives. It's something that we live with. It's present. We say, hey, like, take a step back right now. I got this. Or you can come in. You want to, you know, we can use some tears right now. And it becomes a different way of relating to our shadow selves, actually, that often feel so shameful. We work so hard to keep them locked up that it causes its own ripple effects through our lives.
Yeah. Well, we're we're getting to the point where this is becoming a very long episode, which I don't mind because I could talk to you for so long. I know we touched briefly on an experience that you had with learning about ChatGPT and the power of technology kind of be a mirror for us or provide almost like a role that we want to interact with. I'm excited.
This was such a fun experience for me because I haven't delved into the world of ChatGPT that much, not because I'm anti it, but I just haven't spent a lot of time there. And I had a client come in and say to me that she had this profound experience in between our sessions. And she wanted to share with me and share the transcript with me. And I was like, okay, cool. She was having a very low moment one night, and she has, a lot of dynamics built in her relationship with her father. And she went on to ChatGPT and kind of said, I would like you to speak to me from the perspective of a loving and supportive father. And the ChatGPT said, great, what do you want me to say? And she kind of said, I want you to tell me how proud you are of me in kind of your words. And I want you to kind of just share with me how much I mean to you or whatever. And ChatGPT proceeded to, essentially what she did was she role trained the AI, almost like we do in psychodrama, to enroll someone from your cohort or your class to like, hey, you're going to play my grandmother. This is what she's like. This is how I want you to talk to me. Great. So you role trained your grandmother, a person in your class. My client role trained an AI without even like, this is just brilliant. And then they proceeded to have a conversation. And she said that she was weeping with tears of joy. She'd never in her life heard her father say this. She will never be able to hear her father say this. But there was something, some act hunger inside of her, some place in her that desired so deeply to hear it, that hearing it, even though it was from a non-real source, gave her this real feeling of completion and joy and gratitude that she carried with her throughout the day. And then she brought the transcript in and we talked about, you know, one of the things that was interesting is this is the first time I've ever experienced a client working like this on their own. And it was really fascinating. We talked about, you know, kind of the boundaries of understanding this isn't reality and is there, you know, how do we de-roll? Because in psychodrama groups, there's a facilitator. And so when there's a facilitator, there's someone watching to make sure that you, when you enroll someone and you have this cathartic experience with someone, say, who has passed or that you could never have the conversation with, then the facilitator helps guide you out of it. So you de-roll out of it.
Right.
And you have a safe...
So Danielle, you're not always my grandmother.
Exactly. I'm not always your grandmother. And you can process it in a way that you are held and then you are put back together before you move into your regular life. Because there can be something so highly profound and deep about these experiences, but they can be very intense. And so I was really glad my client came in with a session so we could do that process of re-enrolling her into her own life and then just kind of bringing our cognitive brain back into this very somatic experience of reflecting on it, making meaning of it, making connections between how this was something she wanted to hear when she was younger, how this is something that she does have to grieve, not knowing she will never hear this from her father. But it was just this really interesting, profound moment for me that was kind of clicked a light bulb on being like, wow, this is a tool that we could use in a very interesting way in this as an AI, as like a dramatic projective technique.
I love hearing that story because, you know, as somebody who does believe in, you know, some of the dangers of technology, but also calls myself a techno-optimist, I love exploring the ways that we can use it to actually help us be healthier, better humans. And that's really a lot of the mission of what we're trying to achieve with Happy. And I was really inspired to hear that story. And thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, making me feel like I need to follow up with her and just check back in and say like, because we haven't talked about it in the last couple sessions. Be like, how are you still sitting? How does that feel? You know?
Well, props to your client for being so creative, right?
So creative. So resourceful, so like open and interested. And I think just making sure that if anyone's listening and they want to go use this at home, make sure you're also checking in with someone in your life if you are having profound experiences about this and not leaving it in the AI relationship realm, because that is a little bit of a gray area where it's like, we want you to have someone in person in your life who can share this with you and hold it with you also, even if it's just a friend. Yeah.
Well, Danielle, this was such a moving conversation. Thank you so much for being here and giving us your time.
Thank you.
When people are interested in learning more about your practice, where should we send them? What should they look out for?
Yeah, we can go to my website. It's DanielleLavanis.com. And,
perfect.
Or you can email me, Danielle.Lavanis@gmail.com. And I'm practicing in Los Angeles, but I have a virtual practice. So I meet with clients all over the world and hoping to have some workshops and maybe even a retreat coming up in the spring. So I'll post stuff about that on the website.
Beautiful. And you also have an Instagram account I like to follow.
Great.
It's just Danielle.Lavanis.Therapy.
Danielle.Lavanis.Therapy.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you share a lot of your observations about what people generally like are feeling in the world and also insights you have similar things that we shared today.
Yeah.
And I find it so nurturing to be able to, you know, look at that feed and feel heard often by you, even if we haven't been working together one-on-one recently. I find that I relate very much to some of the trends that you observe and share. And so thank you for that.
Thank you, Tess. It's so nice seeing you.
Likewise. I'm going to wrap up today's session, and please follow Danielle and let us know what you think of today's conversation. Have a great one.
Bye.